So yesterday I spoke a lot about what it is to embody the body, some of the obstacles that interfere with that embodiment, spoke about some of the lessons that we're invited to learn within the body, and how sometimes our struggle with those lessons around mortality, instability, serve to create the kind of dissonance or gaps in our lives that we feel that we struggle with. And we began to talk about the embodiment of intention and what that means, and the centrality of intention in everything that we do, in our thoughts, in our speech, in our actions. And yesterday afternoon we were speaking about, you know, how intention can be both skillful and unskillful, wholesome and unwholesome. That intention is actually shaped by our moods, by our views, by our perceptions, by our patterning, by our belief systems. And so intention is always in a process of being shaped and can be helpful or unhelpful. And that when intention is unskillful, we find the roots of greed and hatred and delusion generally shaping the intentions that are unskillful or unwholesome, and that these are indeed the intentions that move our thoughts, our speech, our actions, shaping them in turn, and often taking us to places quite far from where we wish to be. And that when there is that movement of unwholesome, unskillful intention, and in these are the times when we're most acutely aware of dissonance and the gap between our aspirations and our values and how we're actually speaking, thinking, and acting. Okay? And we had, you know, we discussed a little bit about what is meant by greed, hatred, and delusion, because they're quite big words, and, you know, generally as fairly nice people, we probably wouldn't identify with greed, hatred, and delusion, but as fairly nice people, we can still identify with irritation and judgment and frustration and fear and anxiety and confusion. So understanding, also just remarking yesterday, just acknowledging that intention is the momentum behind all things. It is karma. And that we are always practicing, that we are always embodying something. If we are thinking, if we are speaking, if we are acting, if we are still, there is something that is being embodied. We do not live in intentionless spaces as long as we live. So it's kind of a brief recap of where we got to yesterday. And just before we move on, I just want to check whether there was anything lingering overnight that anybody wanted some more reflection on or any questions about. Yeah.
This lingered with me. I wondered if at some point you could speak to the idea or the issue of human embodied creativity.
I mean, just briefly, I mean, you know, I think it's very good to distinguish between imagination and fantasy. You know, that fantasy is generally a combination of an aversive and a craving mechanism. Whereas imagination is for many people one of the means through which they widen the circle of their awareness beyond what they know. And, you know, so that obviously has, you know, various manifestations in different areas of our life. And I think it has a very clear manifestation in the whole cultivation of compassion. Because when we are asked to, you know, meet suffering, distress with compassion, we cannot exactly know how another person feels. But imagination allows us to extend into that not knowing with empathy, without trying to make everybody else's suffering somehow self-referential, you know, that I know just how you feel. I don't know how you feel, but my imagination allows me to go beyond what I know and to have empathy in not knowing. Yes, Tim.
So ignorance and illusion, the relationship?
They're used interchangeably. Okay, ignorance and delusion are, in the texts are used very, very interchangeably. So ignorance is, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, has those two aspects of not knowing what's going on and not wanting to know what's going on, because that might disturb us and we might have to do something about it. But that ignorance also has the roots in those distortions that I was talking about seeing the impermanent as being permanent, seeing self where there's non-self, seeing the beautiful in the unbeautiful, and the satisfactory in the unsatisfactory. So those are called the four distortions, which kind of really lay out the landscape of ignorance and delusion. And our reaction to those distortions is craving and aversion. Okay? And I think it's really important to pin that down, that craving and aversion are actually reactions to delusion. It's the way that we're trying to make somehow sense of delusion. Yeah. But they are used very interchangeably in the text.
Mind sense? Yeah, when you talked about mind sense yesterday.
Okay.
Were you talking no thought base, or is that thought base?
The sense door of the mind. I mean, yesterday I was speaking about what is going on through the sense doors and how they're the ways that we manifest and embody both the wonderfully skillful and the wonderfully unskillful. Now, in Buddhist psychology, mind comes with a small m. Okay, in Western thinking, I feel very sorry for people's minds, you know, because they get so much blame. You know, my mind does this and my mind does that. You know, my mind doesn't do this. You know, my mind is like that. And it's actually, as a sense door, it is like any of the other sense doors. The sensory information of the mind are thoughts, images, memories, cognitions, perceptions, moods. These are all the sensory information that is shaping the mind of the moment. Okay, so even in Buddhist psychology, it would really not be correct to speak of mind. It would be more correct to speak of the process of minding. The minding of the moment, because it's process-based rather than thing-based. It's a great relief to know that. You know, because if you've got a thing that's very static and solid, it looks rather impenetrable. But if you have a process, it's very accessible. It's very penetrable. Because, you know, and when we spoke about yesterday about the intentions of greed, hatred, and delusion shaping the mind, and then in turn shaping speech and action. So good to see that continuum, okay, that there is intention, there is shaping, then there is the manifestation or the embodiment of that shaping in our speech, in our choices, in our actions, and then in the kind of thoughts that follow. Is that clear? Okay. Yes.
For a long time I've accepted that things senses. But now I think about it, it's not really. And I wonder if you could relate thinking to seeing, tasting. I don't understand.
No, it's thought is not the sixth sense. Thought is the sense impression of the sense store of the mind. It's the sensory information. You know, just as the eye has sights, it's the sensory information, the ear has sounds, the sense store of the mind has thoughts, perceptions, moods, memories. It has that as the sensory information. So then what is done with that sensory information really depends a lot upon the ground in which that sensory information is landing. Is that? Thank you. Okay, are we ready to chug along here? All right, so yesterday the way that we finished up the day, which maybe wasn't the best note to send you home on, was really kind of reflecting on greed, hatred, and delusion, and how when intention is shaped by greed, hatred, and delusion. And we kind of dissected a little bit what greed, hatred, and delusion are. But these are really primary mechanisms that create dissonance, create this sense of gap between what we value and how we live. Sorry, that big one. You know, what we aspire to and how we live. So it's interesting in the Buddha's teaching, he speaks about these three roots of shaping intention that are unhelpful, but that can be understood and indeed can be brought to an end. This is good to remember. And he also very much speaks about the three intentions that are liberating. And I quite like this in the Buddha's teaching. You know, sometimes lists are so long. You know, but three you can remember. You know, it's not a big list. And I often think about this, and I think about the implications of it, and the ramifications of it. If these were the intentions that shaped all of our thoughts, all of our words, all of our acts and our choices, what would our life look like? What would our relationships look like, including our relationship to ourselves? Now, it's interesting in the early texts, you know, how the language that is used is often the kind of language of negatives. So these three intentions are often spoken about as non-greed, as non-aversion, as non-delusion. And said to be the source of all skillful and healing and liberating thought, speech, and action. But translate those in your own mind. What does not the mind of non-greed look like? What does the mind of non-aversion look like? What does a mind of non-delusion actually look like? And then reframe that in your own mind. And how the mind of non-greed is a mind of contentment and generosity. How a mind of non-aversion is a mind of kindness, befriending, and compassion. And how a mind of non-delusion is a mind of clarity rooted in insight. Now, I think it is so important to recognize that when we practice and when we undertake this path, everything we do is not attitudinally neutral. In fact, these three intentions of generosity, kindness, and clarity underpin all wise practice. And the Buddha actually said that without these intentions in place, particularly the intentions of contentment, generosity, and the intentions of kindness, that the path and the practice will not deepen. The path and the practice will not deepen. So I think this has quite some big implications in practice, because it's very easy, like anything else in our life, to draw our formal practice into something of a ritual, something of a rite, something of a routine, and to sit down without actually examining our intentions of the moment. Just as it's quite easy to go into our lives also, isn't it, without actually being particularly mindful of our intentions of the moment. And certainly these intentions underpin all samasati, all wise mindfulness. And wise mindfulness is actually an attitudinal commitment to those intentions. It's an attitudinal commitment to those intentions. They are the intentions that bring peace, that deepen understanding, and that are particularly embodied. And that is so, so important. We all know it's easy to have good intentions, isn't it? But to have the commitment to the embodiment of those intentions is actually where the path begins. You know, otherwise, we have good ideas. Now, think of that distinction for yourself. The difference between having wise intentions, wholesome intentions, and the commitment to actually embodying them. I mean, that is a practice that brings everything in the path into focus. It brings all of the qualities such as perseverance, such as dedication, such as wise effort into focus in a very moment-to-moment way. So actually the commitment to embodying these intentions is the commitment to living in alignment with those intentions. Doesn't mean never faltering, doesn't mean never forgetting, doesn't mean not being, you know, being infallible. All of those happen. But the nature of commitment is that renewal, the renewal, the renewal of intention over and over again, because intention brings forth and cultivates and deepens the wholesome qualities of heart and mind that liberate. Is that clear? Did I actually say that in a way that it landed? Okay, so then I wonder, okay, just a pause moment. Does anybody have anything? Yes. You know, it is it's obviously a much more complex one. How do I practice clarity? How do I renew that commitment to clarity? Well, first we bring that in that first aspect of mindfulness I spoke about yesterday, which is the simple knowing element of mindfulness, the knowing of what's going on. So I think part of that is we need to get really quite familiar and honest about the landscape of confusion. There's a lot of symptoms of confusion. The mind swirls, it's indecisive, it's uncertain, there tends to be more rumination, more obsession, more compulsion about trying to figure things out. You know, so there's confusion has a lot of, it has a big checklist of symptoms, I would say, you know. And I think it's quite very, very, very helpful to actually get familiar with that, because the thing is that we get drawn into that world and into the patterns of confusion, and confusion is trying to solve confusion, usually in a very ineffective way. And so part of the simple knowing, I think, of mindfulness is to be able to recognize those symptoms of confusion, to get familiar with them. If I'm having more than three thoughts on one thing, you know, if my mind is repeating, if I'm floundering, you know, then we bring in that simple knowing. This is confusion. Okay, so the first thing we recognize is that we are not going to practice clarity with a mind that's already entangled in confusion. Okay. So the first thing is the willingness to leave the symptoms alone. The absolute willingness to leave the symptoms alone. Don't go into the floundering, the indecisiveness, the rumination, and ask what is actually can be cultivated in that moment that actually is going to hold the confusion without being lost in it. You know, is it more space? Is it more calmness? Is it more one-pointedness? Is it more kindness? But to leave the symptoms of the confusion alone. Does that make some sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay, so it kind of brings me into this next bit that I'd like us to have some reflection on today, and it's around orientations in on the path. Because this has a lot to do with embodiment, and it has a lot to do with the cultivation of skillful intention. First of all, as I mentioned yesterday, meditation is one of those words I'd like to banish from vocabulary because it's so textually incorrect. I think it's unhelpful, actually. It's my experience. It's unhelpful. I'm going to meditate. Bhavana means to cultivate. Bhavana means to bring into being. So it would be far better to think of yourself as being a cultivator or even a midwife than a meditator. Which brings me into what I want to talk about, which is around orientations in practice. We do a lot of transferring, don't we? We tend to transfer both cultural and personal patterns into our path of practicing. I'm sure we all recognize this. You know, if we're a good striver in our life, we'll likely be a good striver in our practice. You know, if we're a good judge in our life, we're likely to be pretty good at this in our own practice. Now, one of the patterns, I think, that has unfortunately got very, very transferred, particularly in West, it's actually uniquely in Western practice, I think, is work. What I'm working on. Okay, what I'm working on. I remember recently teaching and someone came to me and they said, someone who'd been on the path for a long time, said, this is my first retreat in 15 years that I'm not working on something. I found myself feeling a little bit startled about that, and then I wonder if that's really that unusual. And just actually nobody actually really articulates it in that way. So we have this kind of toxic combination that goes on. One part of that combination is the way the mind is hardwired to be biased towards seeing the imperfect and broken. Okay? It's a hardwiring of the mind. Of the brain. We're hardwired to see primarily what is broken and imperfect and not good enough. And, you know, so the list of that can seem quite long. And combined with that combination, we have a wonderfully developed and sometimes overly developed work ethic. So we see that which is imperfect and we need to work on it. Because we can't actually see there's some other way of actually clearing that which is broken and imperfect. And it does seem obvious that it's that which is broken and imperfect that keeps creating these places of dissonance and the gaps, you know. So if I could get rid of these things or work on them or work them out, suddenly life is going to look a lot better. It sounds like a logical equation, doesn't it? So, we have agendas. We have projects. We might bring projects into our cushion. We might bring projects into our retreat. And, you know, you've noticed that it is endless, and actually as long as there is an identification with self, the list is never-ending. So, that's very helpful to recognize. So, we're never going to clear the list. The list is going to add something new to it. So, you know, one, I might work on my anger, and then I've got my greed to work on, and then I've got my jealousy to work on, and then I've got my impatience to work on. I've got my frustration to work on, you know, I've got my confusion to work on. I'm asking you to accept that as long as a sense of me is reified, solidified, centralized, the list will not clear. Because the very nature of that view of self is to keep picking up objects that are identified with. The very nature of that reified, centralized view of self is to endlessly identify it with something to define itself by, and it very rarely identifies with the wholesome. It doesn't actually, because the very nature of identification is by nature actually unskillful. Okay, it's an act of confusion. So the list will not end. So this is kind of one of the orientations. In fact, it's not new, by the way. It's not new. There's a certain timelessness to this. You know, there's a story in one of the texts where the Buddha comes across somebody in the jungle standing on one leg and asks what they're doing. And the person says, well, I'm working out my karma. And the Buddha says, well, how much have you got rid of? You know, the person says, I don't know. And the person says, how much more have you got to go? And the person says, I don't know. And then the Buddha says, well, how will you know when you're done? And the person says, well, I actually don't know. And, you know, in one of those very familiar, rather testy little lectures the Buddha gives in the early text, you know, you foolish man, you know, this is not the way. And the person sees the light and puts the other leg on the ground, you know, and gets ordained and lives happily ever after. That's kind of how those stories go, you know. Illumination tends to be immediate, you know. It's not a process of I didn't quite understand that. Illumination, it's, of course, why didn't I see that before? So the basic message is, as long as there is a self that is identified with, centralized, the menu and the list of imperfection will be endless. And the work will be endless. Now, there's a very fine line between working on something and self-improvement, isn't there? Because why do I want to work on something? I mean, beneath that, do I hold some kind of unarticulated image of a perfect self? The self I want to be? Is this a kind of near enemy of genuine aspiration and genuine longing, you know, for freedom, for depth? You know, is it a kind of distortion of that aspiration through ignorance to make it a self-description? You know, to have a sense of improving myself to be that person I want to be, and that's a very human and very almost admirable sense of longing twisted into a becoming. And to really see that difference, because self-improvement in Buddhist terminology is becoming. It's bhava, it's the process of becoming someone, something, through identification. Okay, it's the same deal. It's the same deal. And it's not that it's always so terrible, because underneath it, I think there's often, you know, that subtle voice of genuine aspiration, genuine longing for wholesomeness and skillfulness that gets twisted into becoming the better self and becoming the more perfect self and the self that can be more admired and more lovable and more capable. So it's a very, very fine line. But what I do see is this endless working is exhausting. It's unfortunately disheartening. But underneath it, there is the sense of being the owner of the imperfect. That, you know, the jealousy or the greed or the impatience is who I am or belongs to me. So work only, the work orientation only arises on the basis of identification, which is why I think it is so doomed, sadly, to failure. And it has almost a feeling of chipping away at the coal face. And I think it leeches inspiration and joy from the path. It leeches inspiration and joy from the path. I mean, you could imagine there's really very little enthusiasm or eagerness to get to one's cushion if we're going to face another grueling wrestling bout with our imperfections. And, you know, I just don't see any support for this orientation in the early teachings. I just don't see any support for it. It's certainly not an ignoring or dismissiveness of the reality of greed, hatred, and delusion. But it is a questioning of how are we going to approach these aspects of the human condition that can feel so elusive and so inaccessible. How are we going to approach these in a way that genuinely liberates rather than reinforces a tendency to identify, which, forgive me for saying, is one of the aspects of avidya or ignorance. One of the aspects of avidya or ignorance is the tendency to identify and centralize a self. Does that make any sense to you? Is anybody working on anything at the moment? How are we going to make sense, heal, liberate greed, hatred, and delusion if we're not working on it? That's our dilemma. How are we going to do that? Not from the standpoint of ownership, of this is me, of this is who I am. So that's a question. Does anybody have, just want to make sure this, anybody have any reflection? Yes, please.
I am confused about the difference between bhava and bhavana. Could you explain what that was?
Bhava is becoming, bhavana is cultivating. Okay? Bhava is the process of becoming someone moment to moment, or more historically, through the process of identification. Bhavana is cultivation. Okay? Is that good? Okay, so we go back. If we're not working on something, and please, if we could just do a whole sort of like, you know, eradication thing during this weekend of words that are not useful. Words that are not useful. Meditating, becoming, working, you know, if we could just do a whole eradication of words that are not useful in this path. So we go instead to what I see much more the emphasis being in the early text, which I mentioned is this journey and this pathway and this process of cultivating, of bringing into being through the attention that is given to them, through the commitment that is given to their embodiment, the wholesome, the skillful, and the liberating. The ennobling. You know, the Buddha speaks constantly of the encouragement to live an ennobled life. A life of dignity, a life that leaves few residues in the mind, a life of integrity. And as far as I can see in the teaching, the whole of the path is actually built around bringing to fruition everything that ennobles the mind and our lives. That's the direction of the path. So we're learning, and this is not just, you know, these become the intentions that are embodied by the way. They're not just good ideas. These are commitments. They're commitments. They are the intentions that are embodied. So the cultivation of the wholesome, certainly in terms of the kind of core elements of generosity and integrity, but of kindness, of calm, of spaciousness, of compassion, of peace, of contentment. Now, I suppose the teaching of the Buddha was going, these are not imports, okay? It's not that some people have these potentials and others don't. That these are seeds of capacity and seeds of potential that live in every human heart. That again, they're virtues. If I go through that list of four again that I talked about yesterday, they're virtues, they're seeds of potentiality, they're fruitions, and they're cultivations. All four. Beginning with recognizing that those seeds of potentiality lie in every human heart. So it's not about pretending or striving, but of cultivating those seeds. Now, how do you cultivate a seed in your garden? You know, you care for it. You water it. You give attention to it. You tend it. You protect it. You nourish it. It is the same inwardly. It is why, you know, in the Buddhist teaching, you know, these agrarian models and metaphors are used all the time, because it was such an agricultural society, you know, that the Buddha puts out these kind of metaphors that are really rooted in that. But actually they're very real, aren't you? You think about, how do you help a seed to grow in your garden? You know, you don't shout at it. You know, you don't ignore it. It requires all of those things. The commitment, and through their commitment, their embodiment. Now, this comes to something, again, where we have to be willing to be counterintuitive. You know? We have to be willing to be counterintuitive, because that cultivation and the commitment and the embodiment of that cultivation has got nothing to do with what we feel like. Got nothing to do with what we feel like. I remember my early teachings, you know, someone going to one of my early teachers and saying, you know, but I don't feel like forgiving this person that hurt me. And they just looked at them in such a puzzled way and said, what has that got to do with anything? It has nothing to do with what we feel like. And I think this is where I think that the kind of courage and the commitment is that willingness to be counterintuitive. You know, because if we recognize, you know, one of the biggest saboteurs of embodiment is actually the prevailing mind state of the moment of how we feel. Yeah? I don't feel like being generous. I don't feel like being kind. I don't feel like being calm. You know? I just don't feel like it, you know? I feel like being distracted, you know? I feel like being angry, you know? I don't feel like extending myself. In a life governed by moods, cultivation and embodiment, I really wonder how much chance it actually has. You know, and why, I would ask, do we give such authority to the prevailing mood of the moment to govern and to shape and to dictate our actions and our speech and our thoughts? And then, I hear all kinds of resistance to an objection. You know, well, that makes me inauthentic. You tell me there's something authentic about greed? You know? Or there's something authentic about rage? That makes me inauthentic, you know? But actually, this is why it's a practice cultivation. This is why it requires effort and dedication and commitment. But we're not committing to some ideology. We're not practicing some sort of belief system. We're making actually a commitment to the freedom of our own hearts. You know, and we're making a commitment to what intuitively and deeply we know to be valuable and we know to be worthy and we know to be liberating. But it's a hard one to get past, isn't it? In terms, as far as I can see, in the early teachings of the Buddha, relinquishment and unbinding and disentangling and liberating is not an act of self. It's not an act of will. It is through the cultivation of the wholesome and the liberating that there is unbinding. So it's got nothing to do with me letting go. You know, it's got nothing to do with me exercising renunciation, although I may exercise restraint. But it is the cultivation of the wholesome that does the work, has the effect of relinquishing and unbinding the unskillful and the unwholesome. It is generosity, the commitment to that, that releases the tendency towards greed. It is the deepening of metta, of befriending, that releases the tendency towards aversion, judgment, blame. It's really the deepening of the commitment to contentment that releases the tendency to feel that there's an inner sense of lack. So it's almost like a kind of rotation of consciousness, isn't it? Because we often think it comes after. You know, the kindness comes after I got rid of aversion. You know, or their generosity comes after I've got rid of covetousness. I think the radical nature of the Buddha's teaching is that it's the other way around. And that's a bit of a leap for us. Okay, so that's a good place to pause. So does anybody have anything they want to raise? Because I'm going to expand on this after the break. Yeah.
Just a comment on the reactive nature of the habit, of the ego's habit not to do these things, is quite striking in my experience.
Not to cultivate.
Yes.
Yeah. The thing is that you cannot, and I think it's very important, that you cannot separate the sense of self from its shaping factors, okay? So I am not greedy, you know, I am not angry, I am not impatient, you know. It is the selfing, the shaping of the selfing in the moment through the presence of the unwholesome. It's the very belief system that I am these things that actually sets up the, you know, I resist. I don't resist. You know, there's resistance because of the identification with this kind of very contained, very compartmentalized, imperfect qualities that shape me. So it's even that the sense of autonomy of self keeps coming through. You know, and our language is a setup for that. I don't resist. There is resistance because there is the presence of these unhelpful states of seeing. So it's so important, I think, to distinguish that, because we keep even attributing, you know, unwillingness to a me. You know, these layers of me that, you know, and this is, of course, what the Buddha suggested. It's not there in any solid way. And, you know, our language keeps us duping us into that. Also. I often think of, you know, the view of self is essentially a reflex of fear. It's a reflexive motion of fear, which takes a whole lot of different forms. Anybody else got anything up before we... Okay. Yes, please.
I get a little bit confused because I also, you know, talk about cultivation, pulsing factors, and then I've heard the approach of the other way is not cultivation, but to remove aspiration. And then that's which is there comes forth.
So the question, for those of you who didn't hear it, the seeming difference between the presentation of cultivation and the removal of obscuration so that the wholesome comes forth. Now, I don't think they're as divided as they may appear. I think from the perspective of cultivation, it is what removes obscurations. That the removal of obscurations, you have to think, how is that going to happen? Okay, what is the mechanism of removing obscurations? It's obviously not going to happen through willpower. It's not going to happen through forcing. It's not going to happen through wishful thinking. It's going to happen through the cultivation of curiosity, investigation, wise effort is actually going to allow the obscurations to drop away. So I don't think they're quite as separate. So the question I would put back to you is, how are you going to remove the obscurations?
Can you remove it through understanding the mechanism of the obscurations?
That's investigation. That's cultivating investigation.
If you understand the mechanism, well, sometimes I'm still compelled by...
But even that is cultivating the capacity for investigation. And for understanding. Even understanding the mechanism requires the cultivation of investigation and interest and curiosity. I don't think they're as divergent as they appear, is my sense. So, you know, the question I would sit with or invite you to sit with is, how are obscurations removed? You know, and, you know, if you go, like, even to the Satipatthana and the fourth way of establishing mindfulness, as I mentioned yesterday, you know, you see this juxtaposition of the hindrance factors, the obscurations, and the awakening factors. And, you know, if you look in the text, the Buddha is constantly emphasizing cultivate the awakening factors as the way of removing the obscurations. You know, that they're not the byproducts of the obscurations falling away. They're the means of the obscurations falling away. That the awakening factors, you know, joy, equanimity, one-pointedness, energy, mindfulness, investigation, these are not the outcomes of the obscurations falling away. They're the means through which the obscurations fall away.